Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. We hope you all had a successful tax season and are ready to continue learning more about the ever so lucrative world of tax resolution. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call will be on June 6th, so please go ahead and mark your calendars. Like always, before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you have logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants that we have on today, we asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. We will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the question box your name as you entered it while logging onto the call and that you have a question. We will then unmute you when we call upon you to ask your question. We will select participants in the order when you submitted your name on the question box, and once we unmute you, you will be prompted by the system that you have been unmuted and you will now be able to speak for all of us to hear. Now, I know some of you guys are a little shy and don't want to come on live, so you're welcome to type in your question in the question box and I will read it out loud. So now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us for the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman has received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors and has a history of successful execution and helping to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes and bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with the clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxing agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's Practitioners Forum. As a reminder, every Tuesday, TRI offers the following part of our Tax Tuesday series. This practitioner's call on the first Tuesday of each month. This is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost. Tax Tuesday lightning details on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month. Learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. Our featured course on the third Tuesday of each month, and our goal is to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
That's right. That's our goal, guys. Make sure you always remember that. We're looking to help you guys resolve your issue and help you make more money. So let's go ahead and get started with the questions for this month's course. And as a reminder, subscribers and members do get priority. So if you are a subscriber, you are welcome to answer your or submit your questions, and you're guaranteed to get them answered. First one, let's start this off with Angie. She's a subscriber, and she's asking, I understand that when an OIC is submitted, IRS stops collections and installment agreements in place. Does that mean also that if you submit a current tax return resulting in a refund, they will release the refund?
Okay, so on an offer, when it is submitted, it will stop collection, but there's a big caveat, and that is if the offer was submitted in good faith. If the IRS makes a determination that the offer was submitted in bad faith for the sole purpose of stalling collection and not seriously making an offer, they'll continue collection. On installment agreements, you really don't want an installment agreement pending while an offer is pending, because there's different sorts of offers. For instance, there's what's called a lump sum offer, where the taxpayer offers an amount to be paid within 5 months of acceptance of the offer, and to determine the amount, the disposable income in that case is multiplied by 12. There's also a long-term offer where there's payments that are going to be made greater than 5 months. In that case, you multiply the disposable income by 24. And there's also a type of offer called a periodic payment, where the taxpayer makes payments every month while the offer is pending and after the offer is accepted. So, for instance, on a periodic payment offer, you really wouldn't have making payments to an installment agreement and to an offer at the same time. So what we usually do is, if a taxpayer is in an installment agreement, we have them default first prior to submitting an offer. You don't want an offer and installment agreement at the same time. And in fact, before you submit an offer, the IRS has a program called like an offer. What do you know what that's called? It's an offer calculator, where you they put you through a series of questions to determine whether or not you qualify for an offer. I think it's called
the qualifying tool.
The qualifying thing. And they even ask on the Form 656 if you took the qualifying questionnaire online, and you always want to say yes. And they ask you questions, for instance, are you in bankruptcy? Because you can't submit an offer while there's an active bankruptcy. And in the same token, I don't think you could or I would submit an offer while there's an active installment agreement. Now, the second part to this question is, if you submit an offer, what happens to a refund on a current tax return? And the answer is, they keep it. So first of all, there's different kinds of collection. There's active collection, where they would levy your bank account or levy your wages. And there's passive collection. For instance, if there's a tax lien and you sell your house, they put a demand in escrow. And the same thing is true with a refund. And in fact, part of the offer agreement is that you agree that the IRS will take any refunds of up to a year after the acceptance of an offer. So if an offer is accepted and has a refund pending on this current year's tax return, the IRS will keep it.
All right, Norman, thank you for that. Moving on to the next question from Peter, who is also a subscriber. A client of mine filed for bankruptcy Chapter 11 in 2013 and is currently making payments to the trustee. He started to receive notices of tax due from the IRS for years 2014 and 15, which are significant. Can he get the liabilities included in the BK plan, or can he file for Chapter 7 now? He's not sure what to do, and his BK attorney has retired.
Okay, so there's several parts to this question. Also, there's a lot of unknown, so I'll answer it the best I can with the information I have. So the client filed a bankruptcy, a Chapter 11, in 2013. Now, normally in a Chapter 11, the debtor is his own trustee. In other words, unlike a Chapter 13, where there's a Chapter 13 trustee, and a Chapter 11, normally the debtor takes the role as both the debtor and the trustee, except when the U.S. trustee gets involved, because there were some errors made by the debtor, or for some reason the U.S. trustee didn't feel that the debtor was qualified to be their own trustee, and so they filed a motion to be appointed trustee. So I'm assuming in this case that the U.S. trustee took over the case. I'm not sure if that's true. In any case, taxes for 2014 and 15 are post-petition taxes. In other words, those taxes became due after the bankruptcy was filed, so they couldn't be part of the bankruptcy plan. They're what's called administrative claims, and the IRS could do one of several things. One thing they could do is file an administrative claim in the bankruptcy, and an administrative claim is a priority claim, and it would take priority over other claims, so there'd have to be some provision to pay the IRS administrative claim before any other claims, including prior to paying any IRS priority claims. Also, the IRS could file a motion to dismiss the case because of the post-petition tax liability, because that would make the plan infeasible, because the plan couldn't provide for payment of these post-petition taxes by definition. A third course would be that the IRS would allow the plan to pay out, but then these 2014 and 15 taxes would survive the bankruptcy and would be collectible post-bankruptcy. So can you get them, included in the plan? Probably not. Can you file a Chapter 7? No, you can't file more than one bankruptcy at a time. You can't be in a Chapter 11 and then file a 7. And the other one is bankruptcy attorneys retired? Well, I would, if you could, or if you need help, we could help to get in touch with the IRS special procedures and determine what they're going to do. I've been successful in talking the IRS into not filing an administrative claim and not filing a motion to discharge and just allowing those taxes to survive the bankruptcy and have the debtor deal with those taxes outside of bankruptcy when the bankruptcy closes. But no, he can't file a 7 at the same time as an 11. I hope that answers your question.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. Peter, reach out to us if there's any other questions or other concerns you need a little help with that. Moving on to the next question, this is from Avo. Avo was asking, I have a client that missed the audit and now is assessed additional tax. It has been over a year since the audit was performed. What is the process to have the audit reopened to show expenses?
Okay, so when you say missed the audit, I imagine what you mean is that they didn't appear with the revenue agent, and so the audit went through without any documentation or without any input by the taxpayer, which resulted in additional tax assessment. So the first step would have been a 30-day letter where the revenue agent would have sent a copy of the proposed audit report and asked the taxpayer to either agree or disagree, and if they disagree, to provide further documentation to support their position. I guess that didn't happen. And then the next step is a notice of deficiency, which is also called a 90-day letter, and that gives the taxpayer 90 days to file a petition in U.S. tax court appealing the audit. So since it's been over a year, I'm assuming that the notice of deficiency went out and the 90 days have run, and U.S. tax court no longer has jurisdiction to hear the appeal. So then the next step is that I would consider would be submitting an offer doubt as to liability. So what that would be, a way of reopening the audit and being able to provide documentation supporting the expenses. So I would look into, it's an offer doubt as to liability. The form is a 656L. There's no offer fee, and there's no down payment that needs to be made with the offer, but the offer does require that the taxpayer submit some monetary offer. They can't just say, I owe zero and I'd offer zero. They have to offer some amount. So based on the documentation that they could have to support the expenses, they would submit an offer as to the reduced taxes that they would owe if the expenses were allowed based on documentation.
All right, Alvo, hopefully that answers your question. Moving on to Henry. Henry has a question about IRS has made adjustments to the taxpayer tax returns and the taxpayer owed money to the IRS. The taxpayer also will owe money to the FTB. Do you have any general guideline regarding how to coordinate handling of the tax resolution between federal and FTB? Do you finish IRS first and then handle the state, or do you handle both at the same time?
Okay, so first, it looks like what happened is the IRS, either through an audit or something else, maybe a 1099 that came through, made adjustments and increased the taxpayer's tax liability. So what the IRS is going to do then is submit a copy of the audit or the adjustment or whatever to the FTB, and the FTB in turn is going to adjust the tax liability of the taxpayer based on the information provided by the IRS. So if you're going to submit installment agreements or to both the IRS and the FTB, how would you handle it? And one way is to deal with whoever is being most aggressive first. So if there's collection action from the IRS and the FTB is quiet so far, I would start with the IRS, which probably is the way it's going to work out because the IRS has already made the adjustments and the FTB may or may not have already received the information from the IRS. If they're both attempting collection at the same time, then I would submit installment agreement requests for both. If the FTB is being more aggressive, I would submit the FTB first. But ideally, you would want to submit the IRS first. And what you want to do is for the IRS, depending on the amount of money you owe them, you would either complete a 433F or 433A if the case is assigned to a revenue officer. If it's assigned to automated collection, ACS, you would complete a 433F. And for the FTB, that's a form 3561. The thing is, both forms have a place to put as an expense money going towards delinquent taxes. On the IRS form, it would be delinquent state taxes, and on the state form, it would be delinquent IRS taxes. So you only have so much disposable income, and the thing is, you don't want to give it all to the first taxing agency who's attempting to collect, because then you won't have anything left over for the second taxing agency. And if you tell the FTB where all my disposable income's going to the IRS, they're not going to buy that. So you want to allocate your disposable income between the IRS and the FTB. And one way is by allocating it pro rata. So the IRS looks to see how much you owe the state and how much you owe them, and they don't want a payment. If you owe the IRS 10 times what you owe the FTB, the IRS wants a payment 10 times greater than what you're paying the FTB. So you need to kind of set it up. Even if you're only submitting one of them first. You want to have the forms completed, and you want to be able to provide to the other taxing agency the form, or if you've already established an installment agreement, the letter confirming the installment agreement, or the 433D, or the 3567, something to show that you're in an installment agreement. And they also want to know how much is owed to the other taxing agency. This is important because they want to know when the installment agreement with the other taxing agency will be paid off, because at that point you'll have more disposable income and you'll be able to increase your installment payment to the taxing agency. So you want to kind of do it, you want to coordinate them and do the, figure out the installment agreements together, but you may not submit them at the same time. You may decide to submit one before the other. But you do want to be able to get credit from one taxing agency for payments that you're being made to the other to lower your disposable income, because you don't want to have all your disposable income only going towards one taxing agency.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. Hopefully that does take care of that for you, Henry. It can be a little complicated at times, but give us a call if you have any questions. Moving on to Phyllis. Phyllis is asking, I would like to know the steps that should be taken when a client gets a 90-day notice called Notice of Deficiency. What are the options to appeal a 90-day notice?
Okay, so a 90-day notice gives you 90 days to file a petition in U.S. tax court. That's the appeal. So we do it all the time. You just want to make sure that it's filed timely. There's a filing fee of $160, I think, $150 or $160 filing fee. There's a petition that is available on U.S. Tax Court's website, and there's several other documents that are filed at the same time. Notice of appearance, and you also pick a place for the tax court trial to take place. So here we have Los Angeles. I think California might have three or four cities, San Diego, Los Angeles, and maybe San Francisco. So you want to get your tax court petition timely filed and state a reason why you disagree with the audit and the notice of deficiency. Also, you enclose a copy of the notice of deficiency with the petition. And I'm a tax attorney. I'm admitted to practice before a U.S. tax court, and it's a great option to have if the notice of deficiency is issued. Prior to the notice of deficiency issued, there's a 30-day notice issued where you can just appeal it directly to the revenue agent and or the revenue agent's manager. But if that doesn't work, then, yeah, you want to be able to take it to tax court.
So she just, Phyllis just got online and asked me the follow-up question. She's not a tax attorney or not an attorney, so you just explained the options that are available to her for those who can't petition the tax court. If she wants to know, is there other options available?
Well, there is, and that is the taxpayer can file a tax court petition representing themselves, and then you could help them fill in the paperwork, but they would be the petitioner would be their own representative. And then when the case gets assigned to the local IRS appeals office, they're going to reopen the audit, and you could accompany the taxpayer to that appeals conference and submit the documentation and hopefully resolve the issue. Just keep in mind that 93% of U.S. tax court petitions end up getting settled and never going to tax court. So, in fact, I've never gone to tax court. I've settled every tax court petition in the last 20 years with the IRS without ever going to court. So it's not going to go to court. If you have a case and you have documentation to prove your expenses or whatever, then you can settle the case, and it's called a stipulated decision, and you stipulate to how much they owe and if you can't prove it, and then you might as well just stipulate that you owe it and set up an installment agreement, because it'd be a waste going to trial anyways if you can't prove your expenses or whatever to the appeals office. Then you pretty much can't prove it or convince a judge.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Hopefully that helps you, Phyllis. Moving on with the next question is from Corrine. Corrine asks, what is the likelihood of a client getting an offer in compromise if he has already agreed to an installment plan, but now realized that he was not thinking when he agreed to it with the IRS on the phone?
Right. So this kind of similar to the question that was answered before, and the answer is installment agreement is a voluntary payment plan. You can stop it at any time you want by just stop making the payments. Just keep in mind that when you complete the 433A OIC, you're going to have to pretty much come up with a disposable income amount, and it's probably going to be pretty much to whatever the installment agreement monthly payment is, and you're going to multiply that by 12 or 24, depending on how long of an offer payment plan you have, and then that's going to be added on to value of the taxpayer's assets at a quick sale value, which is usually 80% of the fair market value. But that would give, so the amount of the monthly installment payment will give you an idea as to the disposable income portion of the offer.
All right, Norman, thank you for that. And before we move forward to the next question, I just want to interject real quickly. We do have a great turnout today, and I can only imagine that the reason for that is that you all want to keep busy all year long now that tax season is over. As you already know, tax resolution is the perfect way to increase your revenue stream because we want you to be successful, and as Norman mentioned earlier on, we want to show you how to make more money. We want to make sure that you have the support that you need to take on all types of tax resolution cases with confidence. We have decided to offer you a no-strings-attached free platinum membership on our site for 60 days. This is unprecedented. We don't offer this typically for free, and we are extending that to only participants of today's call. So take advantage of everything that the membership has to offer. And just to give you a quick rundown as to what is available, for our platinum subscribers, we do offer free webinars, free e-learning courses, 1 hour, and for those who are getting it for free, get a 1 hour free consultation time. The platinum typically comes with 3 hours, but as we are offering it for a 60-day trial, we are giving you 1 hour of free consultation time, and you also get site-wide discounts on other materials. Again, this is a no-strings-attached offer. You can cancel at any time. Take advantage of the offer and begin taking on resolution clients now with confidence. For those of you who are already subscribers, go ahead and fill in the form if you want to take advantage of what we will do is extend the 60-day trial to your current membership and make sure that you still continue to have access and add the 1 hour. But you have to go into the system, fill out the form, and get me the information. So I am pushing a link now in the chat box. So for those of you who are interested in getting started on this right away, and have the confidence of taking on the clients, knowing that we're here to support you, go ahead and sign up, fill out the form, and we'll get that going for you folks. All right, so that's my quick 2-minute commercial. Moving on to the next question, Norman. This is from Anthony. And Anthony is asking, what is a typical timeline for getting a lien removed? I've never done a lien release and would like to know the general procedure.
Okay, so there's not a lot of information in this question. So there's a difference between a lien release and a lien withdrawal. A lien is released when either it's fully paid off or the 10 years have passed from the date of assessment and the lien hasn't been renewed. So federal tax liens are what's called self-releasing, and that they automatically expire 10 years after the date of assessment of the tax on the lien, and unless it's renewed and there's a window that the IRS has the ability to renew a tax lien, and that is a 13-month window. It's a window 1 year before the 10 years and then 30 days after. So for 1 year and 30 days, the window's open for the IRS to renew the lien. If they don't, then the lien is self-releasing after the 10 years. Now, if the lien should be released because the tax has been paid, the IRS will release it again. They'll release it when the tax is paid. And I think they ask for, it's at least 30 days, but it might be more. And there's a section of the IRS called the advisory group, and used to be the lien desk. And they, if the tax has been paid in full and the lien hasn't been released, then they say wait 30 days, and if it's still not released, then call us and we'll get it released. And otherwise, if the 10 years has expired, then the lien is automatically released. Now, if you're asking for the lien to get removed and withdrawn, withdrawing a lien is when the IRS will remove the lien even though the 10 years hasn't expired and the tax hasn't been paid. And there's various grounds to ask the IRS to withdraw a lien. One would be if you can demonstrate that it would be in the best interest of the government to withdraw the lien. And another is if there's a direct debit installment agreement in place and the tax is below a certain amount, let's say $50,000, then the IRS will withdraw the lien based on the direct debit installment agreement. So I hope that answers your question.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. Moving on to the next question is from Luba. Luba has provided some detail here, so bear with me as I read through this. The question is, trying to abate Section 6662 accuracy-related penalty. So a client was audited in 2016 for three prior years. Those returns were self-prepared on TurboTax. As a result of the audit, which this client managed by himself, the client was disallowed all deductions, even those that could be legally claimed. Schedule A deductions for mortgage and real estate taxes. In addition, the client claimed Schedule C expenses with no income and Form 2106 unreimbursed employee expenses. As a result of the audit, the client was assessed over $100,000 in taxes, interest, and penalties. I was engaged after the audit and lowered the tax liability to about $70,000. The client was assessed the accuracy-related penalty. The client has never been audited before and has never been assessed a penalty. I'm trying to remove the penalty, and I understand that first-time penalty abatement doesn't apply for the accuracy-related penalty. The case is in 90 days notice of deficiency. The only tax that has been assessed is Medicare tax. The client paid this immediately. The initial auditor refused to remove the penalty. Manager contact didn't help either. After we received NOD, the notice of deficiency, I called the revenue agent handling the case at this time, who refused to remove the penalty as well, stating that his tax liability has already been reduced by approximately $30,000. What is the best plan of action at this time? Going to appeals? If yes, when? During notice of deficiency or after the client starts paying tax or pays the bigger portion of it? And also, can the taxpayer advocate help?
Okay, so again, there's a lot of detail, but it's hard to answer without knowing a little bit more. So the question is, since the tax has been reduced $30,000 by from $100,000 to $70,000, is the taxpayer agreeing to the $70,000, or does the taxpayer feel that $70,000 liability is more than should have been assessed? If the 90 days hasn't expired yet, then the proper course of appeal is filing a petition with U.S. Tax Court and disagreeing with the $70,000 and at the same time appealing the accuracy-related penalty. So you have to remember that the accuracy-related penalty is, number one, you're correct, it's not subject to the first-time penalty abatement program. And secondly, it's automatically assessed if the taxpayer gets assessed a certain amount of tax liability. So after getting assessed $100,000 or $70,000 in taxes, the accuracy-related penalty is automatically assessed. The grounds to abate the accuracy-related penalty would be reasonable cause if the taxpayer could show that the accuracy wasn't based on the taxpayer giving inaccurate information to the tax return preparer, but either the tax return preparer made some error or something, or gave him bad advice or something that would be grounds for abatement of the accuracy-related penalty under reasonable cause. The second thing is if you, when you reduce the tax liability, you reduce the penalty because the accuracy-related penalty is 20% of the assessed tax. So by lowering the tax, you lower the penalty. If you, they don't agree with the $70,000 tax and they file a petition with tax court, they can also dispute the accuracy-related penalty. And what I've been able to do in the past is negotiate with the IRS attorneys assigned to the case on, number one, lowering the tax liability, and number two is not only lowering the accuracy-related penalty based on the 20% of the taxes, but compromising with them and having the accuracy-related penalty reduced to 10% of the assessed tax rather than 20, so saving them two different ways. So you may want to file a petition in U.S. Tax Court and work it out there. But I would do that now. I wouldn't wait until the tax court petition is no longer timely. Then your procedure would be to file a offer doubt as to liability, and I think I'd rather take my chances first with the tax court, and then later with, if that doesn't work out, then later with doubt as to liability offer.
All right, Norman, thank you. Luba, hopefully that answered the question. She did do a follow-up comment. Norman, she said taxpayer does agree with the tax but wants to abate the penalties, or follow-up to that.
Okay, then the only grounds to abate it would be under reasonable cause, and you can look that up or you can give me a call and I'll explain it. But there are grounds, and it's usually blame it on the tax preparer.
So this is a great opportunity, Luba, to sign up for that free 60-day trial and use that hour consultation time to get you through this case. Thank you very much. Moving on. Actually, before I move on, I just wanted to mention that I will be opening it up to questions for participants. I have several questions that have already been submitted, so we're going to try to get through the rest of these, Norman, as quickly as possible to make sure that we get to these people online. So Becky asked the question, can you submit an offer after an audit has been completed?
Yes, and you have to wait until the audit has been assessed. So you have to you'd have to wait beyond the 90 days of after the notice of deficiency, and wait until the assessment becomes final, and then you could submit the offer. And I would suggest to wait 240 days after the assessment, so that you may be able to discharge the tax in bankruptcy.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, next one is Beth. Under what circumstances does the IRS award innocent spouse relief? I have a client going through a divorce and just found out she and her soon-to-be ex were audited and assessed over $200,000 in taxes, for which she had no idea what was going on. The husband was a primary person handling the preparation of the returns.
So the thing to remember is that the innocent spouse program is based on equity, and really the question is, would it be fair to hold the other spouse responsible? And there's a couple of things to keep in mind. One is, would it be an economic hardship for, we'll call them the innocent spouse, for the innocent spouse to be liable? So that one thing they're going to do is they're going to look at the innocent spouse's financials and see if it would be a hardship to hold them responsible. The thing that they're going through a divorce, that's good for innocent spouse purposes, because they look at that. And the other thing is that it's based on an audit, which again is good for innocent spouse relief purposes, because if it was just based on the amount on the return and the innocent spouse signed the return, then the point is this innocent spouse knew of the liability when they signed it, so they really weren't innocent. Innocent spouses, they audited the husband runs his own business and was disallowed certain expenses or something, or had additional income that the wife had knew nothing about. So that might be a good way to go. But the thing they're going to look at first and foremost is the innocent spouse's financial ability to pay the tax.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Moving on to the next one is from Henry. Henry has a retired client that has moved out of the country and had his brokerage account levied by the California Franchise Tax Board for taxes dating back to 1996. I filed a POA and spoke to the FTB, and apparently the client had income in California for 1996 but never filed a return. The client states that he moved out of California in 1995 and moved to Florida. What can I do in this case? If I prepare the return, where do I begin in gathering the information? Client has no records that far back.
Okay, so the short answer is, even though he moved out of California, he may still be liable in California taxes if he had income traced to California. In that case, he'd be filing a Form 540 NR, which is a non-resident. But there's a California has a 20-year statute on collection, where IRS's collection statute is 10 years, and if you file a return and it gets processed, then the 20 years would start all over again, and you wouldn't have all that time that the statute had been running. It would start all over again. So I'd think twice about preparing a return. Number one, you don't have the information. Where do I begin to gather it? Maybe from the IRS. And secondly is, you might be better off doing some kind of low monthly payment or something else with the FTB. But even though the taxpayer didn't live in California, it doesn't mean that he's not liable for California taxes.
All right, Norman, thank you for that. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and start addressing the questions that have been submitted online. So first one is from Leslie. What if a client pays his bill, but IRN sends the money back with interest and then sends another letter stating that he did not pay and added even more interest and started a collection on him? So IRS claimed that they did not owe the money, returned the payment with interest, paying it back to the client, to the taxpayer, and then changed their mind apparently, saying that they do owe the money and now added more penalties and interest on that. Apparently, she says, we do have all the paperwork, and IRS is denying all of this. So what do I do?
Well, I would get it. First of all, I'd get a copy of the transcript, the account transcript for that year. And I guess what I would attempt to do is to pay the tax and interest up to the time of the first payment and say that additional interest and penalty was IRS's fault and not the taxpayers. But I would start by getting the account transcript and looking at it and seeing what happened. I mean, the tax was assessed and then adjusted and then reassessed. It seems like the first payment was returned by error, by the IRS's error, and you should be able to. You're still going to have to pay the original assessment and interest up until then. But you should not, I think you'd be able to get away with not paying the additional interest and penalties after the money was returned to the taxpayer.
All right, Norman, thank you. Leslie, hopefully that answers that. Moving on to James. James says, a client already has an installment agreement from a prior year and now wants to do an additional several years and roll them into one. Does this stop the current installment agreement while the new one is pending?
No, so what happens is if a taxpayer owes additional tax for subsequent years after establishing an installment agreement, that's a breach of that installment agreement. And the IRS usually sends out a notice of intent to terminate the installment agreement because they incurred additional tax liability. What we do is call the IRS when that notice of intent to terminate comes and see if we can roll in the additional year or years. They may want an updated 433F, and the installment payments may increase, but it is possible to roll subsequent years into an existing installment agreement. It just takes a little work and a little luck.
All right, James. Yes, sometimes a little luck also goes a long way. Moving on to the next question is from John. John is asking, if a client has filed a Chapter 7 bankruptcy and had taxes discharged and still have new taxes that are due, can the taxpayer still file an offer in compromise? So two things happen here. They discharge taxes in Bankruptcy 7, in Chapter 7, and still have additional taxes beyond that that were not included in the 7.
Okay, so the question is, could the taxpayer submit an offer to compromise the tax liability that survived the bankruptcy or that was incurred subsequent to the bankruptcy? And the answer is yes. You can't be in a pending bankruptcy, but you could have a bankruptcy. As I think on the 656, they ask, have you ever filed bankruptcy? And they'd answer yes. And then they'd ask, you know, when was it filed and when was it case either discharged or dismissed? When was it closed? and give the case number and everything. And but yeah, you could submit an offer to take care of the taxes that weren't discharged in the bankruptcy.
All right, thank you, Norman. Hopefully that answers your question, John. Now Clifford has an interesting question, and we've had this come up a few times. So IRS prepares a substitute tax return for taxpayers with a $20,000 tax liability, then applies subsequent year tax refunds to this estimated tax liability. Taxpayer files prior year tax return without tax liability and substitute tax return is reversed. IRS claims that they don't have to return overpayments from subsequent refund years. Is taxpayer barred by the statute of limitation from disputing this improper seizure of taxpayers' refunds?
Yeah, so the taxpayer has it's 2 or 3 years.
3 years.
Mm-hmm. So if those payments were applied more than 3 years ago, and then subsequently it turns out that they didn't owe the tax, those refunds are out of luck because of the statute, the three-year statute. So that's correct.
Yeah, that's right. So if it's within the 3 years, then they're eligible to get that back, but not after.
Right.
All right. Sorry, Clifford. Wish we had better news on that one. Moving on, Enrique is asking, if my client has more than 6 years taxes unfiled returns, unfiled taxes to present an OIC, how many years need to be filed? All, or there is a specific back years?
All. You can't have any outstanding tax, unfiled tax returns if you're going to submit an offer. And also you'd want to prepare all those returns because you don't know if they're going to owe or not.
Right. It has to do with being in compliance, and you have to be in compliance before you submit an offer. He's also did a follow-up question. What is your best practice, how to collect fees in the case of tax resolution, a pricing guide reference? Well, Enrique, for that, we can take it offline, and we do, as a subscriber, we do provide that information to help guide you in restructuring your business, to show you how to charge, what type of fees, and overall what you should be expecting to get for specific solutions. One thing that I can tell you right off the bat is this is not your typical tax practice, so you don't bill clients for this type of work. You have to collect retainers, and you bill up front. Treat it like a bankruptcy. Norman knows all about this. Just like a bankruptcy, you get paid up front for this type of work. And Peter also mentioned that several times in his other events. All right, moving on to George. A question of a previous comment from presenter. If OIC asked to down liability, you said that the OIC should include an amount to pay. Is that correct, even though the IRS is collecting from the wrong person? 1099 is issued to the wrong person. If so, can $1 be the offer? So his question is about doubt is the liability offer.
Yeah, a doubt is the liability offer can't be zero. You have to offer something. It seems like this could be straightened out with a corrected 1099.
Could be, yeah. But the answer is yes. You want to offer something.
Right. You need to offer something.
Okay. Moving on to Peter.
And just like a regular offer too, you have to offer something. You can't offer nothing.
Correct. That also comes into play when there's no disposable income and no assets when you're submitting an offer. All right. Next question is from Peter. In a situation where a U.S. citizen has outstanding Form 5471 filings for approximately 10 years. Is there any way to eliminate or mitigate penalties for non-filing, and do these forms need to be filed for all open years, or does statute of limitations apply to any years?
You know, there was an amnesty program that was in place. I would look at that. They may be able to fit into the amnesty program. Other than that, I don't know any other way of getting rid of those.
All right, we are coming up here and running out of time, so there's a few more questions here that I'm going to ask. For those of you that we don't get to, we apologize. Make sure you join us next time, or simply become a subscriber, and we can take these offline and use that consultation time to help you with your cases. But moving on to the next one, it's David. David is asking, an owner employer has a contractor or employee that works for him. The owner gives the contractor a 1099. The following year, the employer files an SS-8 and determines that there are an employee and not a contractor for the prior year. Now the employer owes the Social Security and Medicare tax for the employer side. Employer did not withhold from the employee this same tax. Is the employer responsible for the employee portion? An example, who pays the employee portion of the employee? Does it the employee or the employer pay it?
Right. So, no, what happens is if you issued a 1099, then the taxpayer should have paid taxes based on the 1099. And as an employer, you would get credit for the personal income tax that the independent contractor or worker, whatever you want to call them, that you had issued the 1099 to. So you want to prepare a declaration saying that you issued 1099s and they have copies of the 1099s, and then they would need to look at the worker's filed return and payments that he made, and you would get credit for the personal income tax that he paid.
Got it. All right, next question is from Alan. Alan asks, on an approved offering compromise, when can the IRS take the refund of the taxpayer? Is it the year that the offer is approved or the year after the offer is approved?
It's the year the offer's, it's the year the offer's approved, I think.
You know, we'll double check that, Alan, for you and get back to you on that one. But yes, they do take the refund, and the question is whether it's after or the year that it's approved. So,
you know what, I would say approved. Now I think about it, because when you under the new rules, when you submit an offer, the IRS has 2 years to either accept or reject the offer. And if the IRS hasn't rejected the offer within the 2 years, then it's automatically accepted, and they would be able to keep the refund from that year. So I would say it's the year that the offer is accepted. Sorry, thanks.
And as a reminder, there's that 5-year compliance after the offer is accepted, that the taxpayer has to file and pay all taxes timely. So that doesn't apply to the refund, only the 1 year. All right, Alan. Moving on, next question is from John. Compared to taxpayers with wage and income, how good are the chances for self-employed taxpayers to get an offer accepted?
They have just as much chance of getting their offer accepted. They just have to jump through more hoops. So unlike a W-2 employee, for instance, instead of just submitting pay stubs, they would need to submit a balance sheet and a profit and loss statement and maybe not only personal bank statements, but bank statements of their business. I don't know if it's a sole proprietorship or a corporation, but they can do it. They just have to jump through some more hoops and show more proof to show that they're not paying themselves an artificially low salary, for instance, while the company is holding on to money, that kind of thing.
One of the things that the IRS looks at for the offer on a self-employed individual is the most recent Schedule C, as long as it's a true reflection of what's currently happening. So because we are in the beginning part of the year, 2016 Schedule C still holds true for those individuals. So take a look at that if it makes sense.
Those that have filed in April.
That have filed in April, right. Yeah. Right.
Because if you have an extension till October, they're going to the only Schedule C they have is from 2015.
And that's a little old, yeah. All right. With that, again, I apologize. There are several other questions that we did not get to. We are going to go ahead and bank these to address them next time we get on this call. But as another reminder, please take advantage of the offer, the 60-day free membership. We want to make sure that you're successful. We want to make sure that you're confident in taking on these tax resolution cases and have us to back you up and support you. I will be sending out an email reminding everyone of this offer, but this is exclusive to only the people that are on the call this morning. So I hope you enjoy the time. We've got some valuable information. And please visit our website at taxresolutioninstitute.org for more information on not only this, but to all our other courses, webinars, e-learning courses, and materials. Thank you all very much. We will see you next month, and hope you have a great day.